The Curve with Michelle Martin and Bernard Lim replay from Money FM 89.3.
U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are set to meet for a private dinner this evening before a series of meetings tomorrow. The second summit in Hanoi follows their first historic meeting in Singapore some 8 months ago. Joining us for Asia Insider is Joshua Chambers. He's founder and managing editor of a Singapore-based media startup called Gov Insider. Joshua, welcome. First up, let's talk about location. Why do you think the second summit is being held in Asia, in Vietnam in particular, and what does it say about Trump that he has to repeatedly travel to Asia to meet Kim?
Well, I think it says more about Kim than it says about Trump. He's just not welcome anywhere else. He's not welcome, for example, in the corridors of the World Economic Forum in Davos. He's also not safe in many parts of the world. Let's not forget, this is a wanted man who assassinated his own brother in Kuala Lumpur Airport. So that massively limits his travel options. And he always wants to stay close to China and North Korea so that he can feel protected, but also that he can travel safely there. And this time he came by train to ensure there was extra protection and safety as well.
And what about the summit? Why is it being held in Vietnam?
Well, I think that Vietnam is an example of how to transition your economy from a traditional capitalist model into the communist model, into the capitalist model, the free market model that America wants it to move into and would be enormously beneficial for its own people. So when you look at the two summits that have been held, Singapore is ultimately the goal for North Korea's economy. It's what good really looks like. And then Vietnam is that very real example of how things can change very quickly. It's an enormously fast-growing economy. It's very dynamic, but politically it still retains its old communist power structure, and I'm sure Kim is looking at it with great interest.
Well, Joshua, you mentioned how isolated North Korea is, but China, of course, is a close ally of North Korea. It's played a significant role in paving the way for the first summit to happen. And what do you think China wants out of the summit exactly? What do you think they can earn from this?
I think China ultimately wants stability. It doesn't want an unstable, nuclear-armed, failed state on its border, as it currently is. But it also doesn't want to see an American ally right on its border as well. So it will want to see limited progress, with North Korea sanitized a little and brought into the international community, but with relative stability in its own political structures and a suspicion still of the outside world, so that it has that loyalty ultimately to China and to the Chinese Communist Party. It may also want to see Donald Trump a little happier to make its own trade negotiations easier with the United States. Let's not forget that in these negotiations, the U.S. has consistently said that if China helps on North Korea, the U.S. will make things nicer for China in the ongoing trade war. So I think those are the two key things that it wants to see: stability and America happier than it currently is.
Organizing the historic first summit helped put Singapore in the world spotlight. Do you think that this second summit is going to raise Vietnam's profile to its advantage as well?
Well, nobody wants to be number two. So Singapore's image was boosted by being host to this incredibly historic moment of two great enemies meeting for the first time in decades. Meeting 8 months on, while important for world peace, is not as historic a moment, unless, of course, we see an incredible breakthrough. So I think in that sense, it is not going to be as good for Vietnam's branding and reputation as the images of Kim walking around Marina Bay that transfixed the world last year when the first summit was held.
This is The Curve, and we're speaking to Joshua Chambers, founder and managing editor of Singapore-based media startup Gov Insider, about the second summit between North Korea and the United States in Hanoi. As for Donald Trump, he appears to be fond of these one-on-one summits, having also met Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki last year. Do you think these meetings achieve more in terms of optics than any real work going forward on the ground?
I think that's a fair statement. One-on-one summits don't tend by themselves to achieve great historical breakthroughs. If you look at negotiations of the past, it's always work behind the scenes that does it. But this is all part of the Trump reality show presidency, with videos and statements that he's making about winning a Nobel Peace Prize. And it's important to him personally that this is as glitzy as possible and he gets as much attention from it as possible. Nevertheless, that doesn't undermine the work that is actually going on behind the scenes, quietly between the U.S. State Department and North Korea. This summit should be taken as an indicator that the U.S., never mind about North Korea, they're always willing to talk, but the U.S. still feels happy to talk. It feels happy to put its president up there meeting Kim, and that's a statement of confidence from America that they feel that they will get something out of this as well. Ultimately, they're not going to be engaging in this at all if they think it's just boosting Kim's international reputation but not doing anything for the United States, because that will be very embarrassing for Trump in the medium term, and they're not going to want to put him in that position. So it seems the State Department will have briefed him and said, go for this, you can do this, you can publicize this, and we're confident that behind the scenes we're getting something out of it.
Have the summits boosted Kim's international reputation? Since the Singapore summit, we've seen a lack of the fiery rhetoric from him. And despite allegations about him and human rights violations, people still rolling out the red carpet for him today, treating him very much like a superstar. So do you think that in terms of the success of the first summit, it has changed international perception of Kim?
I don't feel that at all. He's head of the most despotic regime on earth. This is all show. He has massive sanctions on him. He can't go anywhere unless it's to negotiate. He loves skiing, but he can't go to Switzerland, for example, where he spent much of his childhood. He is fated, but it's within very limited bounds. He is treated like a superstar at this summit, but in normal life, he is limited very much to North Korea. So this makes him feel the loss even more when he's away from this rolling out the red carpet treatment. He will feel like a normal head of state when he's at this summit. He can engage with the international community. And I think the hope is from the United States that by doing this and by making him see the importance of engagement, after so many decades of North Korea refusing to be a part of the international community, that he will take long-term steps to change North Korea. Let's not forget that President Trump is really in for a maximum of only 8 years. But Kim is going to be in power for decades. And when he looks at his decades to come, what does he want to do for his nation? And what does he want to do for his own circumstances? Does he want to be fated, continue on the world stage, as the person who brought North Korea into the modern world, the person who did something for the economy, and also the person who did a great deal for peace? Or does he want to be like his father and grandfather, totally isolated with only one ally, constantly worried for his own security and hated outside of his country? This is the choice that America's putting to him, and it's giving him both options by showing him one at this summit and making him live the other every day.
Yes, it is interesting to see how his image is changing through these summits. But in the lead up to Hanoi, I mean, U.S. President Donald Trump was talking about the possibility of the two nations being at war if he hadn't done all the things that he's done in this process, I guess we saw a vague commitment to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula from the Singapore summit. So are expectations much higher this time, do you think, as far as concrete results are concerned?
I think expectations are lower this time. I think after seeing that nothing really came out from the summit last time, people don't expect a dramatic breakthrough. But perhaps commitment to this process, negotiating, not making belligerent threats, and not firing missiles directly over Japan is a result in itself. By continuing this process, it does bring Kim into the international arena, and it allows for the potential for change. But there's no nation, once it's had nuclear weapons, that has ever denuclearized. There seems to be no real suggestion from Kim that he wants to give up this leverage. And actually, just the other day, the American Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said that the difference between North Korea and Iran is that North Korea now has nuclear weapons, and that's why the Americans are negotiating with them. So that strange statement sort of shows why Kim won't want to make too much progress in these talks, because if he does, then suddenly he has a less good negotiating hand. I think, as I say, commitment to this process is really all we can hope for. Other than that, there may be some small games. There could be the symbolic end of the Korean War. But the problem with this is that actually, again, it plays into Kim's hands, because By doing this, it opens up the potential for trade between North and South Korea, and that boosts the North's economy without America getting security gains that it wants from it. What may very well happen is that Kim allows U.S. inspectors onto North Korean soil to see the two deactivated missile sites that were working last year. This doesn't see him give up the missiles. It doesn't see him give up many of the missile sites, but it does show a commitment. It gives both sides the opportunity to show that they've made some progress, and it gives Trump something really concrete to point to this time as round as well. And ultimately, it will be a historic moment to have American troops on North Korean soil inspecting nuclear weapons and missile arms dumps. So that's probably the best outcome that we can hope for.
We'll keep an eye on the story for you, of course. On the Curve, Trump and Kim to meet at the Metropole Hotel at 6:30, about an hour's time. In the meantime, a Pakistani military spokesman has said that Pakistan shot down two Indian Air Force planes in its airspace in Kashmir today, adding one Indian pilot had been captured. News agency ANI reporting India has also shot down a Pakistan Air Force F-16 fighter jet. The jet was shot down in Indian retaliatory fire some 3 kilometers within Pakistan territory in the Nowshera sector. Islamabad said it struck across the line of control, the de facto border between India and Pakistan, from within Pakistani airspace. Joshua, what do you make of the sudden escalation in conflict between India and Pakistan?
Well, we've just been talking about North Korea and a potential threat in the medium term from their nuclear weapons, but this to me is far more worrying and scary. You have two nuclear-armed nations with a history of conflict really gearing up and going at one another, and it doesn't look like it's going to de-escalate soon. So it's incredibly worrying. The rhetoric is incredibly worrying. There have been multiple wars between Pakistan and India, particularly along the line of control in Kashmir. And I think we really need to see some progress and some de-escalation soon, because the tension here and the potential for risks and for catastrophe is quite high.
With Joshua Chambers, founder and managing editor of Singapore-based media startup GovInsider, talking about some disturbing developments between India and Pakistan. I mean, on the ground, the two nations recently exchanged fire along their contested border in Kashmir, while analysts say there haven't been tit-for-tat airstrikes between the two nations since the 1971 war. So how worrying is this current situation?
It's very worrying. I think when it comes to tit-for-tat strikes on the ground, that happens very, very often. There is constant state of conflict in Kashmir between Pakistan and India, and people in Kashmir who are born in Indian-controlled Kashmir but are loyal to Pakistan as well. So that is a constant drumbeat and has been for a very, very long time. There have also been multiple ground wars fought over the line of control. For example, the invasion of Kargil by Pakistan. So there have been continued problems there. It's the airstrikes that are worrying. It's the shooting down of planes that are worrying. The last major incursion into Pakistani territory was a couple of years ago when India made a surgical strike again under Prime Minister Modi, to strike at these terrorist training camps. It alleges that it believes are training people to carry out terrorist attacks in Kashmir against Indian police force and also the Indian armed forces as well. We can only hope that it continues as is now with tit-for-tat strikes that doesn't escalate further. The rhetoric seems to imply that it won't escalate further than this. It hasn't done historically for a very long time, and there is some drumbeat of tension that's always occurred between troops on both sides of the border. But we do need to see some international consensus on this soon, and we need to hope that international actors step in and make some changes and help to de-escalate the situation.
Thank you for joining us. Joshua Chambers there, founder and managing editor of Singapore-based media startup GovInsider.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.